This is Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Plato. Now that the fighting in Iraq is largely over, soldiers, including former prisoners of war, are making their way home. And if past wars are any measure, some of the returning GIs will experience lasting psychological effects of this war. Some will be permanently changed. This hour we'll be talking about how war affects the psyche of soldiers. We are familiar with the term post-traumatic stress disorder, but what does that diagnosis mean? Who returning from the battle theater might be a likely candidate for PTSD? Military psychiatrists were mingling with the soldiers in this war, looking for signs of stress. We'll talk about how the military is dealing with the mental health of our troops. So if you'd like to join our discussion, perhaps you're a vet or someone who is having trouble coping with the effects of this war, the last one, Vietnam, World War II. Perhaps you're a physician, nurse, other health caregiver who works with soldiers in combat. Give us a call. What do you think? Our number, 1-800-989-8255. Let me introduce my guests. Dr. Jonathan Shea is a staff psychiatrist at the Department of Veterans Affairs Outpatient Clinic in Boston. He is also the author of Achilles in Vietnam. His latest book is Odyssey in America, Combat Trauma. Odysseus in America, Combat Trauma and the Trials of Homecoming, published by Scribner. He joins us from WBUR in Boston. Thank you for being with us today, Dr. Shea.
Hi, Roy. It's a pleasure.
Thank you. Lieutenant Colonel Elspeth Cameron Ritchie is a psychiatrist for the Medical Corps and the Program Director for Mental Health Policy and Women's Issues in the Office of the Assistant Secretary of Defense for Health Affairs in the Department of Defense. She joins us from Falls Church, Virginia. Thank you for being with us, Dr. Ritchie.
I'm delighted to be here.
You're welcome. Ben Shepherd is the author of A War of Nerves, Soldiers and Psychiatrists in the 20th Century, published by Harvard University Press. He joins us from the BBC Studios in Bristol, England. Thank you for being with us, Mr. Shepherd.
It's a pleasure.
Dr. Shea, what is, let's define some terms. What is post-traumatic stress disorder?
Well, Ira, you may be asking the wrong person in that I greatly dislike that term, because post-traumatic stress disorder, at least among veterans, is an injury, a battle injury, just like getting the tip of one's finger or one's arm blown off. We don't speak of someone who's had an arm blown off as having missing arm disorder. But it is, in my view, very simply the persistence into civilian life of valid adaptations and responses to the situation of mortal danger. So in civilian life, these become not only not useful, but positively disruptive and dysfunctional.
Why do you say I'm asking the wrong person?
Well, because I'm not a subscriber to the American Psychiatric Association's approach to this whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
That's the official terminology.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Ritchie, do you agree?
I think it would help the listening audience to know what PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, is according to the diagnostic guidelines, and then to acknowledge that, yes, there's a lot of controversy mm-hmm. about it. Post-traumatic stress disorder, or PTSD, is a diagnosis that's given when somebody's been exposed to a very traumatic event. They have a response of fear, helplessness, or horror, and then they can have a number of different symptoms that persist for a while. That's why it's called post-traumatic. And the different symptoms fall into the following symptom clusters. There can be re-experiencing of the event. There can be avoidance of the stimuli. And along with that can be numbness and detachment. And then there can be increased arousal, hypervigilance, or difficulty concentrating, sort of like the adrenaline rush that has been going on just keeps on going and going.
Mm-hmm. Ben Shepherd, you call it a cumbersome phrase devised by a cumbersome committee.
Well, that's a reference to the circumstances in the 1970s which gave birth to PTSD, and I could talk about that for a very long time. Let me just try and see if it's to say very quickly. At the time, there wasn't a term current which dealt with the, which covered the problems which veterans were perceived to be having. And therefore, the American Psychiatric Association, after a lot of toing and froing, a lot of lobbying, a certain amount of emotional blackmail, came up with this term, which, for the reasons that Jonathan Shea has described, is not perfect, and there are all sorts of problems with it, but it's there, we're stuck with it, we can't do anything about it. It's arrived.
I agree we are stuck with it. And if I use it subsequently in the program, it's because I acknowledge that we're stuck with it.
What would you rather call it? How would you rather describe
psychological
it?
Injury. Psychological injury, very simply.
Yeah, I would simply call it psychological injury as well. I wouldn't use the word injury. I would say the psychological after effects of war.
Dr. Ritchie, you're in on that?
I think that either term can be used. I think one of the important points is there's both the acute psychological effects of war and the longer-term psychological effects, and sometimes they all get lumped together under the PTSD rubric, but they're really a variety of different effects of war.
Give us a, describe some of them for us.
Well, acute effects of combat or of other traumatic experiences, maybe things like nightmares and insomnia and hypervigilance, and these are all actually what we consider normal reactions to an abnormal situation. What becomes a problem is when these symptoms keep going on and go on for a long time and get in the way of somebody's functioning. Either they're functioning at work or they're functioning at home.
Mm-hmm. Were psychiatrists in the theater this year during this war looking for soldiers who might be suffering?
Yes, psychiatrists and psychologists and social workers were there both before the soldiers deployed and then in theater with them, working especially closely with them after any particularly traumatic events. And then they're also helping them get ready to return to the United States. And once they get back here, will also be available working with the troops to see if they are having difficulties and if they are, to help treat them.
Oh, and what kind of symptoms would they look for?
The ones that I just mentioned, the soldier might bring, or if they're having difficulties functioning at work, if perhaps they're irritable, they can't concentrate, they can't get their tasks accomplished, if they're perhaps seen to be teary-eyed in settings that you wouldn't normally expect it. And, you know, a lot of it's not necessarily going to be done by the psychiatrist or mental health to identify these folks. The military is a very tight-knit, very cohesive group of people now, and so people are going to be watching out for each other. And actually, the first line of intervention is going to be what people can do for each other. But if they're concerned that it's a little beyond what they can do, then we really encourage them to refer their fellow soldier or themselves to either a chaplain or talk to their commander or go see somebody in mental health.
So there's no stigma attached to soldiers seeking help.
Unfortunately, I cannot say there's no stigma. We try our best to reduce the stigma, and as much as possible, we get out of our offices and down among the troops so somebody doesn't have to, you know, tell their sergeant, hey, I got to go see the shrink. But instead, we try to be among our troops, working with them in primarily an educational mode. This is what you might expect. These are normal reactions to abnormal situations. And then once a soldier or Marine has seen us and trusted us, then they may decide, hey, I need a little bit more, and come in to go see the doc.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
The value of simple education cannot be overstated. It is incredibly valuable. First of all, people don't feel like freaks. But I want to say that what Colonel Ritchie is saying about the lack of stigma doesn't map over the whole of the forces. The junior enlisted forces can get help, although there may be some cultural obstacle to it. But the career NCOs and officers still have a devil of a time getting help because it's simply career-ending for them. And that, I think, is a big mistake.
And this is Dr. Ritchie again. I'm going to have to disagree with Dr. Shea here, although we agree on many things. I don't think that getting help is necessarily a career ender. You know, after 9/11, we worked very extensively at the Pentagon with the support of the highest levels of command in the Army, in the Navy, in the Air Force. And we really reached out to all ranks, all the types of people, and a lot of senior enlisted and officers got help without any kind of impact on their career.
Could I just make another point,
sure,
picking up something which Dr. Ritchie said?
Mm-hmm.
And that is that the most important psychiatrists in any war are not psychiatrists. The most important psychiatrists in any war are the politicians and the military leaders and the junior military leaders. And that's the most important kind of psychiatry that is ever done. And that will determine how the soldier feels about the conflict that he's been in. Does he feel that it was a just and necessary war? Does he feel it was a well-conducted war? Then there are other factors, like the economic circumstances, whether he gets a proper homecoming. There are all sorts of things which actually are far more important historically than the nitty-gritty psychiatry And this is the point that Jonathan Shea has begun to make in his recent book, I think. That's what really matters, and that's why you get such variety across from one society to another after different wars. If the war's lost, you have a kind of poisonous fallout, which is completely different.
Well, Dr. Shea, he's spoken for you. Wouldn't you? Would you agree with that?
Well, I strongly believe that the most important community for a returning veteran is the community of his surviving comrades. And so from that, you won't be surprised if I say that the single most important preventive psychiatry recommendation is to train people together, send them into danger together, and bring them home together. This is something that our military institutions can do, and it has nothing to do with mental health professionals. It has to do with the way the institutions do their business.
And it's been pointed out many times that was one of the problems in Vietnam is the one-year tour of duty. You never wanted to get to know the guy in the foxhole with you.
It was pointed out in 1945, before that.
Mm-hmm. That's right. This isn't new with me.
Is it still happening now? Was it true in the last few wars?
Well, as I understand it, what happens is that units come back from a deployment, even if indeed they are brought back individually, which I mean brought back as a group, which often they are in the recent events. But then the unit just gets blown to the winds as the personnel system reaches in and reassigns virtually everybody.
And why is this so important, this band of brothers concept?
This is Dr. Ritchie.
Yes.
We know historically that units that have good unit cohesion and good morale do much better than units that are, quote, ash and trash, just kind of thrown together at the last minute. If you look at the Ranger units or Special Forces, traditionally their rate of acute psychological casualties is very low. So, yes, I agree with Dr. Shea that there's a critical importance of a unit working together, going into theater together and coming out together, and that's really what we've moved to over the last dozen years. I disagree with him a little bit on the units getting blown to the winds once they get home. We're working very hard to make sure that the unit cohesion can continue after people get home, although I have to admit that's an especial challenge in terms of the reservists who may be dissipated back to their individual civilian jobs.
Is it because there's a breaking of trust that I've read in all of your works that seems so important here?
Well, the breaking of trust is most painful when there has been a failure of expert, ethical, and properly supported leadership within the forces. I'm not talking so much about the national level leadership. I'm talking about the direct leaders that the person in a fight relates to.
Mm-hmm. There's another issue here which Jonathan Shea hints at in his book but doesn't pursue, and that is the thing that now that we all have regular armies, essentially we're sending certain people in our society out into the field to fight on our behalf. And if we don't join them, if they feel they're on their own, which to some extent was the case in Vietnam, then they're going to have different feelings afterwards, and they're going to use weapons that may be available in terms of compensation, in terms of using medical symptoms, to right what they think is a wrong.
Mm-hmm. All right, we're going to have to take a quick break and come back and talk lots more about this with my guests, Dr. Jonathan Shea, Colonel Elspeth Ritchie, and Ben Shepherd. So stay with us. We'll be right back. You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking this hour about the mental health of soldiers returning from war with my guest, Dr. Jonathan Shea, whose latest book is Odysseus in America, Combat Trauma and Trials of Homecoming, published by Scribner. He's a staff psychiatrist, Department of Veterans Affairs Outpatient Clinic in Boston. Lieutenant Colonel Elspeth Cameron Ritchie, a psychiatrist for the Medical Corps and the Program Director for Mental Health Policy and Women's Issues in the Office of the Assistant Secretary of Defense for Health Affairs in the Department of Defense. Ben Shepherd, author of A War of Nerves, Soldiers and Psychiatrists in the 20th Century, published by Harvard University. Our number, 1-800-989-8255. Let me ask a question about what happens when you find someone who is suffering in the theater. Do you... Do you take them out and try and send them home, or do you put them like, you know, they've fallen off a horse and try to get them back into the fight, Colonel Ritchie?
We have found, looking at all the wars in this century, especially World War I, World War II, and the war that you forgot when you talked of the Korean War.
Oh, I haven't forgotten that war.
We found that if you take them out and send them home, they do not do very well. There's a lot of stigma associated with it, and they tend to retain their symptoms. Well, if you treat them up close to the front lines with the expectation that they will return to duty with very simple treatments, then we found that 60% to 80% of them can return to duty. The other piece of it is if you started evacuating everybody out of the theater who was having difficulties, you might not have very many soldiers or Marines left to fight. So it's much better to say, hey, I know you're feeling bad. Let's have something to eat, some sleep, and then, you know, you're going to get back in and join your buds. And people feel much better when they stay with their unit and they continue the battle.
Hmm. Hey, in terms of the officers, the lieutenants, people who are supervising, to use that word, commanding the troops, how do you prevent what I'll call the general patent effect of, you know, just going in and slapping around some kids who seem to be shirking their duty and not just, you know, and loafing versus people who are and sensitizing them to the fact that these symptoms may be real?
Fortunately, our officer crew is very well educated, and the military, by the way, has a major investment in the mental health of its troops. So for a number of years, we've been educating the officer class about, as well as non-commissioned officers and the junior troops themselves, about combat stress reactions and combat stress control, and the understanding that just about anybody who has enough or seen enough can break down. That doesn't mean the person's a coward or a bad person, but means that they need a little bit of kind of restoration, preventive work, and then they can get back in and fight again. And since our statistics have been so good about returning soldiers and Marines to combat, then the officers believe us because it helps retain the fighting strength.
Could I just add something there,
yes,
which
Ben,
is that General Patton did lose his command after slapping the soldier, so yeah. Maybe that message has come across.
Well, Ben, let me ask you this. In your history, and you've looked through many wars in your book, does the brutality of any one war being more than the other, and we're talking about Korea here before, which I've known many people said they've been through all of them, say that was one of the bloodiest of all wars, does it affect any, you know, more or less the psyche of the troops?
I think one of the things one has to make clear here is that the general lay assumption is that it's the worse the situation is, the worse people will be affected. And it isn't as simple as that, because everybody brings to a situation their own previous personality, they bring to the situation their own military training, etc. So it isn't simply just the magnitude of the stressor, it's also the circumstances under which it's encountered. Now, Korea, I think, and I'm not an expert on Korea, my impression of Korea is that the troops there were not initially, at any rate, tremendously well trained. They weren't very good troops. And I think that may well have been a factor in the whole thing in Korea. Whereas you have other circumstances, for example, where should we say in Normandy, where, you know, Omaha Beach, that's pretty horrible, but that was Rangers and pretty good units, and they coped with it. So I think one has to be a bit wary of making this equation between the magnitude of the awfulness of the situation and the levels of psychiatric problems afterwards.
May I point out that our elite formations have always been getting the good resources of cohesion, expert leadership, and prolonged cumulative and realistic training. And there's a tendency to imagine that their elite performance somehow is derived from some special characteristics that they have as individuals. Now, they may well be quite special individuals, but research in the 1980s on stable units showed that you can get elite-level performance out of very ordinary, unselected troops just by giving them the good resources. And the veterans I serve are determined that the armed forces give every American service member who goes into harm's way these good resources of cohesion, leadership, and training.
Colonel, would you like to weigh in on this, or just go?
Well, I think the military in general has really progressed, and so all of the military now has a focus on unit cohesion. Remember, we're an all-volunteer army, and of course it's true for Marines, Air Force, and Navy, and we've got a very highly educated force. And we've realized, we being the highest level of command, that personnel are a most important and a very expensive asset. So I think that we've really learned from the mistakes that were made in Vietnam.
All right, let's go to the phones, 1-800-989-8255. Let's go to Miami. Hi, Roger. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you. Hi. I'm listening to this with great interest because I did my doctoral dissertation where one of the variables was post-traumatic stress disorder. I have a doctorate in clinical social work. Subsequently, I do employee assistance program work with federal law enforcement. And I wanted to comment on the fact I wanted to comment on the statement made that people in the upper echelons going for help for PTSD is a career-ending move. I think if the mental health professional on the job is doing his or her job correctly, that is not necessarily the case. One of the things that we often do are like what we call ride-alongs, where we're down in the streets with the officers all the time, and they do get to know us. And we are consulting with the officer corps on helping the line staff. So that if anyone anywhere along the line is having any type of problem, if they know, quote, the shrink, they can always say, hey, doc, can I talk to you for a minute? And it's just like having any other conversation in the hallway, only then you can step off and take it a little more private. But it does not have to be a stigmatizing interaction.
This is a good example of Woody Allen's law. Showing up is 90%. If the combat stress control teams don't get deployed on exercises at the National Training Center or at the Joint Readiness Training Center, then when the troops are sent into a fight, they say, well, who are these people?
Exactly. It takes a while to build up the trust level, but once they know you and once they know you're a regular guy, just like they are, you know, then it goes a long way for credibility and trust and a development of a therapeutic relationship.
I'm reminded of the Dr. Friedman character in MASH, who would,
exactly,
would show up periodically and remind them to have some fun if they could at some point. All right, thanks for calling.
Thank you.
1-800-989-8255. The fact that you were saying, Ben, that there doesn't appear to be a correlation between the bloodiness of a war and predictability of what's going to happen to individuals, that would say that even though we just finished a 26-day war in Iraq, at least the fighting part that we saw, the main battle part, would that say we should not expect, it's unpredictable what kind of post-traumatic stress disorder we're going to be seeing coming out of this
war? I think it is very unpredictable because, of course, the last time around, everybody said it was a stroll, and look what happened with Gulf War Syndrome. So, you know, there may be all kinds of horrible things lurking in the woodwork here. The British had a short campaign in the Falklands and congratulated themselves rather afterwards about what a great job they'd done, and then they turned out to have a lot of problems. So, I mean, yeah, I mean, a short campaign on the face of it is better news than a very long campaign, yeah. But we just don't know, and there will be a lot of surprises lurking in this situation. And I think it depends a lot on the way this war comes to be perceived, and that depends a lot on what kind of peace emerges from it.
I would like to piggyback on Ben Shepherd's remarks. Although from this perspective, it seems like a short conflict. For many of our troops, they've been over there a long time, six, 7 months. They've been dealing with sandstorms, with civilians, apparent
Absolutely.
Civilians who have turned out to be enemies, with the threat of chemical and biological warfare. And in retrospect, we haven't seen those agents used, but we had a lot of concerns that they would be, you know, suicide bombings, the sites of dead bodies. So those are all kind of the things we're concerned about. The other part of the equation, again, is how well-trained and professional our troops are and the real emphasis on proactive mental health. I'd like to say one thing. You mentioned the combat stress control teams. Those are teams of mental health professionals who, along with chaplains, are in the theater and working with our troops.
How many are there? Can you give us an idea of the density per population of how many, one per X number of troops?
No, I cannot. Unfortunately, we're not supposed to say the specifics of operational details, but I can say that they have been very much part of the planning process, and they are, along with the surgical assets and medical assets, and by the way, we have a lot of medical assets over there doing a terrific job, they're very much part of the planned response.
Are the families of returning soldiers being given any guidance now how to, you know, to help their returning loved ones deal with?
Yes, they are, and there's a variety of venues they're getting that through, whether it be family support centers or websites. In general, we try to prepare both the soldier, Marine, and the family for what it's like to be reunited. A lot of times there's expectations that it's going to be perfect, it's going to be a honeymoon period, but instead what may happen is that the soldier or Marine who wants to come home and sort of have a couple cold beers and sit down for a while and rest, there's all these lists of chores to do, and the kids have grown and changed, and it can be disconcerting for both the family member and the soldier, so we find that preparing people in advance for that makes it a little less awkward. We see fights happen, just arguments between families very often before deployment and after deployment, and people can get terribly anxious about them arguing or quarreling, and when you say that, you know, a quarrel may actually be part of what most people go through, then it takes some of the anxiety out of it.
Could I just join in there for a second? There's this anecdotal thing that after the Falklands campaign, some members of one unit were flown straight home and reunited with their families immediately, and other members of the same unit came home on a ship from the South Atlantic. It took 2 weeks or whatever. They were with their peers and getting drunk every night, etc. And subsequently, it turned out that the people who'd been reunited immediately with their families, their prognosis turned out to be worse than those of the people who'd had a time to be in this, as it were, this decompression chamber before they were returned to the civilian world. And a lot of this stuff historically is about trying to find a sort of decompression chamber so that people can pass through and reacclimatize before that you go from the awfulness of the battlefield to the kind of banal comforts of home.
Dr. Shea, do you find that with your patients?
Well, the veterans I work with talk about feeling like they'd been dropped in from Mars when they were pulled from their unit at the end of their tour of duty, put on a helicopter, then put on an airplane, and end up on the streets of South Boston, sometimes 96 hours or less from a firefight out in the boonies. And the transition going home in a plane load of strangers that fast was a disaster. Now, I want to mention something fascinating and I think quite astute that the Canadians did with the light infantry regiment that tragically got hit by friendly fire in Afghanistan. But I think that's not the important point of it. It's what the way they thought about this. They took the unit to Guam to clean up, to rest, to talk to each other, and had a very unintrusive and just watchful mental health component present, but not digging into them. Their families weren't with them. Then they brought them back to their base in Western Canada and said, we expect you to show up for work, for light duty, for about a week. You'll turn in your equipment, do paperwork, and you'll be with your families. And during this time, there was again a watchful but unintrusive mental health presence and a lot of education for both the families and the veterans. And then, at the end of the week of light duty with their comrades on the base, they went on their, whatever it is, two-week or three-week post-deployment leave and went wherever they went for this vacation. So they didn't just plunk them back and say, well, thank you very much, you now have 3 weeks of leave, and go be with your families with all this stuff rattling around in your brain and no place to share it.
We're talking about returning soldiers this hour in Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. Are these people going to be watched to see how they were, clinically, to see how this worked for them? Do we know if they're going to be seen, if this is an improvement, they're going to be followed?
This is Dr. Ritchie.
Yes.
Yes, they will be, although they won't be watched by a team of shrinks observing every move, as that could do more harm than it could good. The Army has looked at the Canadian experience that Dr. Shea was discussing, and they're hoping to integrate the best pieces of that into a decompression home. I think part of coming home is for all the unit members to be monitoring each other and taking care of each other. And then if somebody is having a special difficulties, then usually a chaplain will say, hey, come into my office, or we'll go out and chat with them. But, yeah, we really will be watching out for the mental health of our troops.
Mm-hmm. Will you be doing follow-up studies like the Israelis did?
Research is always a very sensitive issue, but we are very committed to following the health of our troops really from cradle to grave. There is a post-deployment health assessment that's going to be done that will look at a variety of both medical and psychological areas. So yes, the answer is we will be doing research, but in a sensitive manner so it's not perceived as being intrusive.
Ben, how come we only heard about this for the Vietnam veterans if this kind of problem has been happening for so many wars?
If you'd been around in 1946, you would have heard nothing else. When people came home from the Second World War, there was an extraordinary bombardment of stuff on the news media, in cinema, everything, which was designed to ease their path home. One ingredient of which, quite interestingly, was advice to women about their role. Women after the Second World War were given a very specific role by the whole society, and it was their job to kind of ease the path back into civilian life of their menfolk. They were supposed to forget infidelity. They were supposed to withdraw gracefully from the workplace. They were supposed to kind of return to the kitchen sink and just generally let their husband gradually reassert himself and be masterful again. And that's what they were told to do.
All right, we're going to come back and continue with this conversation, talking with Dr. Jonathan Shea, Lieutenant Colonel Elspeth Cameron Ritchie, and Ben Shepherd, talking about the returning GIs and the problems they may face psychologically. So stay with us. We'll take more of your phone calls. Don't go away. You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flato. A brief program note. Join Neil Conan on Monday's Talk of the Nation for a discussion on who should decide U.S. foreign policy. We're talking this hour about the mental health of soldiers with my guests, Dr. Jonathan Shea, Lieutenant Colonel Elspeth Cameron Ritchie, and Ben Shepherd. Our number 1-800-989-8255. Let's see if we can go to the phones and start answering some of the questions we have out there. So let's go to San Francisco, to Judith in San Francisco. Hi, Judith.
Yes, hello. Hi.
Hi.
My son is with a Marine Infantry Reserve unit, the only one to my knowledge that was activated and sent to the front. He wrote one particularly disturbing letter where he said that, though, you know, he was getting used to the sight of so many dead bodies, not so much the stench, and that he no longer recognizes himself when he looks in the mirror. And I was just wondering, you know, what I can do to help him when he gets back, and how do I recognize, you know, signs of deep trouble, deep problems that need intervention.
My goodness. Anybody want to start? Dr. Shea, you want to start that?
Well, I would say that, first of all, nobody ever gets their innocence back.
Yeah.
And certainly no one forgets, and the veterans I've worked with have taught me very vigorously that forgetting is not a legitimate goal of treatment. They regard it as dishonorable.
So you don't want to, you don't want them to repress those thoughts?
They have no choice, and furthermore, they would regard themselves as dishonored mm-hmm. if they forgot what they right. had done, what they had been through, who had died. And so the other thing is, though, that I would respect their need to pace any disclosures that they choose to make, that they pace it themselves. Remember, they're concerned that they not injure you. They understand about secondary trauma, that you can be injured by knowing what they know. And so they may, your son may try to protect you. So don't pressure him. Oh, you've got to debrief with me. You've got to tell your story to me, or otherwise you're going to be ruined. That's not so.
If I could add to that, I think that that is a great and very important question. In most cases, a person is going to have positive growth as well as some negative reactions, and as much as possible to draw on that positive growth. You know, the old saying was, war makes a man out of you. Of course, 15% of our troops now are female, so we can't really use that phrase anymore. But realize that he may well have grown up, but at the same time, I fully support what Dr. Shea said, that there may be some difficult pieces to it that he needs to handle at his own pace.
Where can Judith turn to for some help in handling this locally, if she's in San Francisco, for example?
And your son is a reservist, you said.
Yeah, he's a reservist. He's probably amongst the last to go in. I think he went in the end of February. And he's also going to be amongst the first to leave. And so I'm worried also that he won't have that period of time to decompress, as you mentioned earlier.
Most bases have family support centers. I don't know about what you've got in San Francisco, because as you know, it no longer has a large military presence the way it used to. But I would think that if you contacted Camp Pendleton or contacted the unit, because it's usually somebody left in the rear, that somebody would be able to help. A lot of bases are offering family support groups for the parents specifically.
Mm-hmm.
I want to say that the reserves and the guard really have the greatest vulnerability here because of that lack of the family support system, which is very robust on many bases. The American Legion is trying to provide some resources to reserve units. I don't know the details of that. But remember that there is an outfit called the Vet Centers, officially the Readjustment Counseling Service of the VA. It's not in VA hospitals. It's very much community-based. They do excellent work, and they have fine educational resources for families of veterans.
Yeah.
All right, Judith?
Thank you very much.
Could I just make a general point?
Go ahead, Ben.
Yeah. The general point I just wanted to make is that repression is in itself a perfectly legitimate coping strategy, which for some people works okay. We shouldn't necessarily assume that you have to get things out, and that by getting things out you necessarily facilitate a cure, to put it in very simplified terms. Repression is how lots of people in Europe coped with the Second World War. Repression is how lots of people have coped in the former Yugoslavia. It has its uses for certain people in certain cultures.
1-800-989-8255. Let's stay in California a little bit, move down the coast to L.A. Steve in West L.A. Hi, Steve.
Hi there.
Go ahead.
My question involves an incident, I believe, that occurred at Fort Bragg, and I'd like to address it to the colonel. You talk about all these programs and stuff that deal with things, and yet you had an incident that involved, I believe, four non-coms at Bragg that were these elite unit soldiers that you're talking about, where they brutalized and actually killed some of their family members. And I'm interested to hear what the Army was doing to spot that and why it happened. And I don't see, you know, I think this was even pre-war. I believe this occurred 2 years ago or so. And it seems to me as though these remarkable programs are kind of left with, you know, wanting in the way they do it. I mean, you've got four individuals here who, slipped through the so-called system of your constant policing and monitoring and making the Army family work.
Would you address that? Colonel?
Yes, in response to the events at Fort Bragg, the Army sent down an epidemiological consultation team that looked at the cases and also looked at the climate at Fort Bragg. They did surveys of the family support groups. They talked to the schools. They talked to the soldiers. They talked to the spouses. They took the incidents very seriously. And in response to that have been some changes that we're now incorporating. And, for example, one of the things that was learned was there's still a problem with people leaving the unit to go seek mental health care or counseling. And so because of that, there's further emphasis on getting out and being among the troops. Now, it's a challenge. I don't think it is easy in many ways when people have been at war. To bring them home quickly can be a problem. And again, that's part of the reason we're looking at the longer decompression phase that's been talked about.
Is this the protocol then? Would that be the protocol now to try a longer decompression phase? And if, and until we get to that, Dr. Shea, is there a protocol for dealing with this? How what steps you might go from step to step to try? Or is it very individual?
Well, it certainly the local command plays a large role on how that is done. But I want to emphasize that this new technology of the internet is a wonderful way for members of a unit that are coming back from a fight to stay in touch. That's one thing. Another thing is that in my book, I do emphasize that military unit associations, as contrasted to the mass membership veteran service organizations like the VFW and the American Legion, which do a lot of good in some ways, but I don't think really have it when it comes to giving returning veterans an opportunity to communalize their experience.
Does the fact that this war, that war now is so interneted, so communicative between groups, units, individuals on the ground, do soldiers feel like someone is there all the time with them, more from a central location, and is that important to their mental health?
I think soldiers take more comfort from their buddy being next to them than they do. They may or may not have that good internet access when they're in the field and then there's the sand and the dust storms and things like that. So, you know, it's a funny combination of new technology and then the age-old wisdom that we've learned getting back to that band of brothers concept.
Talking about the soldiers in battle this hour and Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News.
I mean, actually, from what my experience of being in the United States in the first 2 weeks of the war, I would have thought there's a slight problem here where people have to be one moment relating to their buddies and the next moment relating over CBS to their mother back home. That's something which is quite new about this war, it seemed to me.
1-800-989-8255. Let's see if we can go to the phones again. Let's see how many calls we can get in. James in Little Sioux, Iowa, is that one? Is that correct?
Yes, Little Sioux, like the Indian tribe.
All right, go ahead.
Okay, well, I was involved in an unusual situation. I was a medic in the Air Force in the Vietnam era, was transferred to a British base, and there was an extortion ring going on among some of the troops. Everybody was afraid of them, and they were trying to, the leadership was trying to get somebody to talk and so they could prosecute them, and nobody would. Eventually, I did, and they decided they would use me as bait to have something happen to me so that they could press heavier charges against these people. So eventually the hostility of the extortion ring of people was focused on me, plus a lot of other people decided maybe I shouldn't have turned them in, maybe they weren't such bad people. So in my case, there was no community of comrades, and it grew rather intense. As a matter of fact, there were a couple of attempts on my life. And so when I left, when this thing all quieted down, it was as though nothing ever happened, although about a year later I began to have a serious temper problem, and as a matter of fact, I shook my fist in a major's face, but they didn't do anything to me. They'd hide me in the X-ray room and sort of protected me because I think somebody felt guilty over what happened. And when I returned to the service, I went to graduate school, and one of the first things somebody told me was, "We'll get rid of you, you fascist. You don't belong here," because I was a veteran. And so after I came back, the...
So you got it from all sides, in other words.
Yeah, I was getting it from all sides. The hostility of the people that I was in graduate school with, and then when I, at home, the people had seen my cousin come back, and they were looking at the signs, and so I, that they, maybe something had affected him. So,
we're running out of time.
Sorry.
Do we got a question? Just one of the.
Going to make a comment that I was able to manage to get through all of this on my own, and it helped me in the long run because it I appreciate my life a lot more than I did before all of this happened. So I think I'm a stronger person.
Mm-hmm. Any comments from our guests?
I'd like to say that cohesion is simply a phenomenon of nature, like electricity. If it bakes your bread, it's great. If it electrocutes your daughter, it's terrible. And criminal gangs do sometimes have terrific cohesion. And so when a group in the military goes bad, the consequences can be extremely ugly, as James has described.
All right, we've run out of time. We'll pick this up some other time and continue. I'd like to thank my guest, Dr. Jonathan Shea, staff psychiatrist, Department of Veterans Affairs Outpatient Clinic in Boston. He's author of Achilles in Vietnam. His latest book is Odysseus in America, Combat Trauma and the Trials of the Homecoming, published by Scribner. Ben Shepard is author of A War of Nerves, Soldiers and Psychiatrists in the 20th Century. Lieutenant Colonel Elspeth Cameron Ritchie is a psychiatrist for the Medical Corps and Program Director for Mental Health Policy and Women's Issues in the Office of Assistant Secretary of Defense for Health Affairs. Thank you all for joining us this hour.
Our program, a great pleasure.
You're welcome. Our program is produced by Annette Heist, Clementine Wallace, Senior Producer Karen Vergoth. Charles Berquist is our web producer and director. Our intern is Adrian McDonald, and we had help today from John Hoder in Boston and Peter Sidoli in Bristol. And we'd like to bid au revoir this week to our intern, Clementine, who has been a great help to us over the past months, and she's leaving to get a real job. How do you like that? A real job in journalism. Good luck to her. If you'd like to write us, please send your letters to Talk of the Nation Science Friday, 1221 6th Avenue, 37th floor, New York, New York, 10020, or you can surf over to our website at sciencefriday.com, where we have back issues of Science Friday. You can listen to them on Real Audio. Take them with you on your audible.com player. And we have Science Friday's Kids Connection up there. All the material that we have on Science Friday is turned into curricula for students and teachers to use free of charge. So drop over to our website. Also, any of the links we talked about today, anything to do with the veterans that you might have missed, you can surf over to the website there, and Charles has them up for you to click on and follow them. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.